Welcome to the Proceedings Podcast. I'm Bill Hamlet, the Editor-in-Chief of Proceedings at the U.S. Naval Institute. Today is Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. Good, as always, to have you on board, everybody. Today's show is sponsored by Valetta Industries.
Today's episode is brought to you by Valetta Industries. Valetta Industries is a premier maritime and tactical training company founded and comprised of former U.S. Navy SEALs. They offer best-in-class trainers for the Department of Defense and local law enforcement. The Valetta team has a passion for instructing and continuing to support the mission of active duty personnel and first responders by lending their hard-earned experience to those brave Americans who still serve. If you're a government contractor looking for a great partner for your next big project, Valetta Industries is an SBA-certified, HubZone, and SDVOSB company. Valetta Industries, we solve problems. To learn more, go to www.valettaindustries.com.
My guest today is Vice Admiral Peter Godier, U.S. Coast Guard. He is the Deputy Commandant of Operations for the Coast Guard. Admiral, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Bill. It's great to be here.
Great to have you back at the Naval Institute. So first off, I want to talk about what's going on in the Port of Baltimore. So a couple weeks ago, the motor vessel Dolly had an elision with the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Big disaster, national news. Describe for our listeners the unified command structure, because there's a lot of people reacting to that event, and how that is being addressed, and what's the Coast Guard's role in it?
Certainly. Well, I mean, starting off just acknowledging the tragedy that happened 3 weeks ago, early on a Tuesday morning. Actually, one of the very positive things is how well this response has actually gone. And in large part, it's because of the doctrine that we have here in the United States in terms of how we respond to disasters, how we respond to emergencies. So the unified command, as we call it, consists of the United States Coast Guard on the federal side, plus the Army Corps of Engineers. On the state side, it's the state police and it's the State Department of Transportation. And then the city and the county of Baltimore are very much involved. But in terms of how this works, the unified command construct enables just right in the outset of an emergency and disaster, what have you, for the right agencies with the right capabilities and authorities at the federal, state, and local level to come together just within minutes and form this construct under something we call the Incident Command System, which is in the plans and doctrines for the United States. So we got off to a really effective start, beginning with the search and rescue case, as we well know, which then turned into body recovery, recovery of the human remains, which is being led by the Maryland State Police in the Unified Command. Mm. And sort of as the objectives have shifted in terms of the priorities, as we shifted into the main objective of opening up the navigation channel, removing the debris, and reopening the Port of Baltimore to vessel traffic, it shifts to an Army Corps of Engineers primary thrust, where they have the authority in terms of the navigability of our waterways throughout the United States. And so you can kind of see here how we have these agencies with slightly different authorities and capabilities that can all come together against a common set of objectives and just make it happen.
Who's the quarterback for the operation?
You know, so honestly, all the agencies are in charge, and yet no agency singularly is in charge of this. It helps, I think, that the Coast Guard has sort of broad authority and capability in terms of maritime safety, security, and environmental protection. And whether it be a hurricane or a bridge collapse, whether it be a ship that's having a problem, a fire like we saw recently in the Port of New York and New Jersey, the Coast Guard brings incident management capacity and just a culture of interagency engagement. So we can come in, and we're not really the quarterback, Bill, but I think it enables us with our broad authorities and having this incident management muscle memory to come in and then really help be the main coordinating agency.
Got it. Okay. I think that's a good segue to talk about the Maritime Transportation System, the MTS. A lot of Americans are unaware of just how busy the waterways and the ports and, you know, I think this Francis Scott Key Bridge incident showed, you know, what happens when a waterway gets blocked, right? Baltimore's the main import port for automobiles coming into the United States on the East Coast. And so that's one of the things that's, you know, a supply chain blockage kind of thing. But without knowing it, I think every American relies on the MTS, right? Yeah. To some level for our gross domestic product, imports, exports, and all that stuff. So how would you describe the maritime transportation system? And then how important is it to the U.S. economy?
Yeah, Bill, to your point, what's been really interesting to us, you know, we're in the Fellowship of Sea Services here, right? Represented by U.S. Naval Institute, the Marines, the Coast Guard, the U.S. Navy, Maritime Administration. We think about maritime all the time. And what is always surprising is the realization that with the Dolly incident, people now realize that we have ships up to 1,200 feet long, greater than 95,000 deadweight tons that transit through our waterways, under our bridges, through our communities every single day. And it really isn't until something goes wrong that the general public tends to think about this.
Right.
Not just Baltimore, think about COVID. Think about the supply chain crisis that we had. People then focused on the port of Los Angeles and Long Beach, where we had a backup of vessels and just challenges in offloading cargoes and things of that nature. But the reality of it is, to your point, we are really dependent as a nation, as a maritime nation, on the free flow of commerce in the maritime transportation sector.
Yep.
Over 90% of our imports and exports happen by sea. There's more than $5 trillion of economic benefit every single year to maritime transportation. And it's not just in our coastal ports. It's also in this inland waterway system, the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Ohio River, and tributaries that help elements of the U.S. economy, like farmers, deliver their goods through the Western River system, down to New Orleans onto deep draft vessels, and then enables us to have international markets for the things that we produce every single day here. It's something that we tend to think about and we take for granted.
We do in the sea services,
Well, I think, you know, the average American just doesn't think about maritime commerce.
If you don't see it, you don't think about it.
That's right. And they just, you know, we automatically think that it just happens and it needs to happen. But to that point, it's tremendously important. And the Coast Guard plays a leading role in terms of the safety, security, and environmental protection of our over 360 ports, over our tens of thousands of miles of waterways and coastal areas. But we do this in concert with maritime industry because our maritime transportation system is primarily private sector, market driven.
Yep.
We play a safety security role. We do have regulations that make sure that in cooperation and collaboration with these maritime partners that everything flows smoothly.
Gotcha. So one of the things that I've really enjoyed since being here at the Naval Institute is I've had more exposure to the Coast Guard with the proceedings team. We're constantly publishing a lot of stuff by Coast Guard officers. And I've learned a lot more about the sort of breadth and depth of all the different mission sets and problem sets that the Coast Guard is tasked with dealing with, right? Top of mind, illegal, unreported, unregulated fishing, climate change, sea level rise, offshore energy, cybersecurity of the ports, autonomous systems, gray zone conflict, deployments to, you know, the South China Sea and the Persian Gulf. The Coast Guard's everywhere. I interviewed Admiral Tiangsen, the Coast Guard Pacific Area Commander, a couple months ago, mm-hmm. and I loved his saying, that his area of responsibility was Dollywood to Bollywood,
yeah.
Hollywood to Bollywood, right? And polar bears to penguins. That's a large area of the globe. So, as my optimistic fighter pilot friends would say, you work in a target-rich environment. Mm-hmm. How do you manage all those challenges? And what does it take to lead an organization that has to the Coast Guard's like 40,000 people. It's a small service. How do you lead an organization that has to prioritize and deal with so many big, complex problems?
Yeah, it's one of the great things about being in the Coast Guard. It's incredibly intellectually stimulating. You know, one day you're thinking about search and rescue and how we're managing that and how, as a program, we're improving our performance for the American people. On another day, we'll have a crisis like what we're experiencing in Baltimore. On another day, we're preparing for a hurricane and helping our port partners wind down the maritime transportation system in a location that might be hit, and then restarting that after landfall of a hurricane in a particular location. We, like as a Title X military organization, think in terms of our national defense. Mm-hmm. And we operate forward in a joint environment to help protect and preserve our American values in the international rules-based order every single day. So it's a wonderful portfolio, but it does, is to your point, make it really challenging on a day-to-day basis to manage the whole thing. So you start with priorities, right? We have 11 statutory missions in the Coast Guard, and woe to me to try to list all those things out. But what we try to do is view this in a whole as the Coast Guard as a maritime governance organization. So our blend of statutory missions, our capabilities, thinking about how the exclusive economic zone or navigable waters or ports and waterways, and then moving out into international waters and our less governed spaces, how we provide maritime governance domestically and then globally. And we have of late, just realizing that our demands are increasing every single year. The recognition of the Coast Guard as a maritime governance organization is critical, not just to our homeland security under the Department of Homeland Security, right, but also our national defense as a Title X military organization too. It has really forced us to establish priorities. So what we do is we look at sort of fundamentally search and rescue as our principal life-saving, life-sustaining mission set, the thing that we're known most for.
Right.
That is something that we have a really sacred agreement with the American people to keep up and be a no-fail mission. So we need to keep strong in search and rescue. But we just talked about maritime transportation system, and what we've affirmed within senior leadership in the Coast Guard is making sure that our marine transportation system is available for legitimate use, for the free flow of commerce, for those who use it for fishing and for making their living, and for those who use it for pleasure. That is also a preeminent thing for us, whether that be aids to navigation, operating our vessel traffic centers, our captain of the port roles, in over 40 different locations is an absolute priority. And then moving out, we have counter drug, we have illegal and unreported fishing, as you say. We've got to sort of rationalize all this in any given way. But the good thing about it is we're a multi-mission organization. Every cutter, every aircraft, every coastie in any given location is a multi-mission asset to us. And we can just sort of shift and toggle in any given moment, depending on what we're facing, into whatever that mission set is on a priority basis.
Okay. All about priority.
Kind of hard to wrap your mind around, but it works.
But, you know, yeah. That global mission set, right? Arctic, you know, polar bears to penguins, 11 different statutory missions. Complex and very different, as you mentioned, search and rescue to counter drug to defense, support to Pentagon, support to national defense and security issues, maritime security, ports and waterways, aids to navigation. It's a almost a mind-boggling different, you know, set of priorities and mission areas.
Yeah, and the good news with that is, so USNI is steeped in history, right? Great, great organization to just examine and lift our collective naval histories. Well, so the Coast Guard really started as a conglomeration of different agencies that were established based on needs. So you start with the Revenue Cutter Service. A gleam in the eye of Alexander Hamilton, right? Written into the Federalist Papers. This young country needed a way of collecting revenue from customs in our nascent ports in the 13 original states, right? So that was the foundation of the Coast Guard. But one of our earliest acts was establishing the aids to navigation, lighthouses, Boston Light, our original light. And so that was a foundational element of the Coast Guard. And then you look at the steamboat Sultana, the tragic incident that happened on the Mississippi River when, right at the end of the Civil War, the Union Army individuals who were in a Confederate prison of war camp were being transported back home. The boilers blew up, and over 1,000 of those Civil War soldiers, Union soldiers, perished, which became the foundation for the Steamboat Inspection Service and the basis of our maritime safety mission in the Coast Guard. And so with a succession of these individual agencies established, the Life-Saving Service, these then all merged into a single whole that is our now modern Coast Guard. And it gives us that powerful background, that powerful history with these different authorities, Title 10 military, Title 14 law enforcement, Title 50 intelligence, a regulatory authority, and now a cybersecurity agency that has international affairs, that has intelligence, enables us to just be a powerful maritime governance organization that can flex into these different things. And let me just give you a contemporary example of this. So we have now homeported a small fleet of fast response cutters, 154-foot long cutters in the Indo-Pacific. We've got three of them in Guam and three of them in Hawaii. And we intend, with the support of Congress, on building those out for a number of reasons, one being that Indo-Pacific is a priority for the Coast Guard, is a priority for the military and our own national security. So on any given day, one of those fast response cutters is going to be operating in conjunction with a small Pacific island nation through a bilateral agreement, and we'll be helping them to enforce their own fisheries law in their exclusive economic zone.
Okay.
And then something happens. A boat goes missing in the Federated States of Micronesia, the FSM. This was in the news recently. And so we will help a country like FSM launch a search and rescue case. We will mobilize a Navy P-8, long legs, great search capability, that found those individuals on an uninhabited island, and they wrote help on the beach out of some palm fronds, right?
Yeah.
The Navy found them, so we dispatched a fast response cutter to go and recover those individuals. Their boat ran up on a reef, got hold, they got stranded. So we go on the beach, and guess what? Because of our diverse coasties that operate there and worldwide, it turns out that one of the coasties that was crewing that fast response cutter was related to one of those individuals who had been stranded and needed to be rescued. So we bring them on board. So we'll do law enforcement, we'll do search and rescue, we'll do international affairs, we'll do national defense operations, all with that same fast response cutter.
Got it. Lots of hats.
Lots of hats, yep.
Yeah, exciting. I want to delve into one of the problems and issues that you just described a little deeper. So the president recently signed an executive order that institutes mandatory reporting of cyber incidents or active cyber threats endangering any vessel, harbor, port, or waterfront facility. So what does that mean for the Coast Guard? Is this leading to more oversight, more inspections? Do you need more people with cybersecurity skills? How does that EO, executive order, impact the Coast Guard?
Yeah, all of the above. And it's a great intro into the Coast Guard as a cybersecurity agency.
And you're here today at the Naval Academy for an event on cybersecurity.
That's right. Vice Admiral Aschbach, our information warfare preeminent three-star in the Naval Services, is hosting all of us to just sharpen the spear in terms of information warfare. So the Coast Guard as a cyber agency has actually three different responsibilities, a little bit different than what DoD does. The first is we need to protect our own networks, the DODIN, right? And each element, each military service under U.S. Cyber Command does that check. The second thing that we do is we actually operate in and among cyberspace. We have a cyber mission team that's certified under U.S. Cyber Command, operates under their authorities, does offensive operations in that sense. But here's the unique thing about Coast Guard cyber. We have an obligation to help the private sector protect and defend themselves in the maritime transportation system. So port facilities, vessels that operate in U.S. waters need to be cyber secure because they're a critical infrastructure sector. And so the Coast Guard helps them do just that. We have cyber protection teams that on a voluntary basis can go and help private sector entities do things like network mapping, do penetration analysis, look for vulnerabilities, even find maybe malicious cyber actors on their networks. But here's the thing. We didn't, until we had that executive order, have real clear authority in terms of protecting ports, protecting vessels when there are cyber threats. That executive order gave us that. So now a captain of the port in over 40 locations where we have our shore operations, if there's a detection of, like, say, a ship that's coming in that might have a cyber threat, we can then direct that ship to take certain actions, like move to an anchorage, secure themselves, be boarded by the Coast Guard. Maybe we can do a joint assessment to determine what the threat of that ship to the maritime transportation system might be. But you had mentioned the workforce, and I think we, like other military services, other government agencies, need to continue to build our people. Retain really great folks who have these exquisite capabilities, years of training. One of the things that we've done in the Coast Guard to do that is we've created a cyber mission specialist rating, a brand new rating in the Coast Guard, so folks can have a real clear career track. They can see what their future looks like. We get them the requisite training, and then we have all the workforce shaping tools to keep them in the Coast Guard. We did that with a warrant specialty too, and we've hired on a cadre of really great civilians who can provide us the continuity and the leadership to help make sure the workforce is strong.
So you mentioned that the captain of the port authorities and the 40-odd shore facilities around the country that have, a captain of the port, are they likely to have a cyber specialist who, when there is a threat, either to the port, the infrastructure, or to a ship that's coming in, who can go out and, check out a network, check out a shipboard systems and detect viruses, detect threats, help protect or isolate the threat?
Exactly right. I think you hit the nail on the head. Each one of our nine districts has a civilian, a cybersecurity civilian expert, and each one of our sectors has a cyber expert as well that provide us that that expertise, that continuity. Somebody that the captain of the port can call on in order to get done what needs to be done. But then we also have these, I think the way the Coast Guard organizes is, we have frontline sort of generalists, right, that do all these different missions. But then they can call back for assistance from these cyber protection teams under Coast Guard Cyber Command, who can then deploy with more advanced capabilities if there needs to be like a network mapping and things of that nature. And as an example of this, we actually have a cyber specialist who's on the investigation team on the motor vessel Dolly, so we can help rule out whether there was a cyber element of that particular casualty.
Yeah, I know in the early days after that incident, there was speculation, and you know there's an ongoing investigation, and from what I'm reading, it doesn't sound like that was caused by any sort of a cyber attack. But that's something that has to be thought about, right? Ruled out, investigated, and you want to make sure that anything in any future incidents like that aren't caused by a cyber attack on the ship's navigation system or other things of that nature.
It's a new world, isn't it? So
it is.
Whereas in the olden days, when we do an investigation, we'll have somebody who will look at the propulsion system, somebody who will look at the fire suppression and control system, somebody who examines flooding and structural stability and that sort of thing. And now we need to have somebody who knows what they're doing in terms of cyber to rule out those things.
Wow. So we've touched on this certainly already, but give us a sense of what are the most challenging aspects of your current job. And if you want to talk about any of your previous jobs, because you were the Coast Guard Pacific Area Commander, you also worked on the follow-on to the Deepwater Horizon incident, which was that massive oil spill in the Gulf, what was that, 12, 13 years ago or so. What are some of the most interesting, challenging aspects of your career, the path that you've had and the current job that you have as a DCO?
Yeah. Well, it can come on you fast and furious, right? Like we were just talking, on any given day, I could be thinking about how the Coast Guard needs to improve our proficiency to get ready for this amazing transformation in terms of fuel systems that are more environmentally sound that might be coming our way to meet a carbon neutral fuel mandate for commercial shipping by 2050. In another moment, we'll be thinking in terms of, wow, we're getting offshore wind leasing up in New England and then now in the mid-Atlantic, it's going to be moving into the Pacific, also to provide environmentally friendly fuel energy sources. But we need to make sure that we have offshore sea lanes or fairways so that ships can still transit safely,
right,
as industry is now putting up these Eiffel Tower-sized wind turbines out there. And then we need to be thinking in terms of, malicious behavior in terms of China in Southeast Asia and what the Coast Guard can do in order to do our part as part of the joint force in order to get after that problem set. About operating in the Arctic. So it's an incredibly diverse portfolio. But, as a guy who doesn't actually run operations, as a guy who runs policy and capability and strategy for the Coast Guard, I think our real challenge is within the cycle of the OODA loop that keeps getting tighter and tighter and tighter in this really dynamic world that we live in, it's providing the operational commanders with the capabilities that they need for these increasing challenges. And I think I share this challenge with my DoD counterparts. When you look at how we budget in the U.S. government, in the U.S. military, where we're looking out 2-3 years and then, sort of drawing a line in the sand, and then the budgets actually come, and they come like mid-year, fiscal year, and they're different than what you want and what you would hope for, and now you need to flex into how am I going to adjust my capability appetite based on what I actually get? And yet technology is driving capabilities and the threats at a much, much higher rate than that. It's figuring out how within the budget cycle that we can help operational commanders with things like unmanned systems. So an example of that is finding a little bit of money in a given fiscal year to field things like sail drones. And we're operating sail drones, which are unmanned surface vessels that are sensor equipped, off the north coast of Haiti in order to sense and deter the potential for a surge in flow.
Yep.
And we're working with Four Fleet that's doing a lot of great things, and Fifth Fleet is, and other fleets around around the world, in terms of integrating unmanned systems and improving our ISR. And then the mesh networks necessary to provide the operational decision maker the right information at the right time. It's things like fielding more advanced drones on Coast Guard cutters, and we've been doing really well with the Scan Eagle system on our national security cutters, but we need to be thinking in terms of you know, other sensors, other capabilities that might improve the decision space for our operational commanders.
Are you putting smaller, like quadcopters, on small boats or smaller, you know, like the response cutters, that kind of thing?
We are, and I think what we're realizing is we just need to give permission to our frontline operational commanders to do things like buy the small drones for whatever purpose they think that they might have, other that might be beneficial to them. We've been doing some testing of some drones off of fast response cutters. The challenge here is that we need these detect and avoid systems when we fly drones, especially in U.S. airspaces, so we meet the FAA rules.
Right, right.
That's kind of maturing. And our research and development center is working to try to get us to a place where we can that can just be ubiquitous, right? Because we see the future, where we can improve our operational performance by fielding drones like that too. We're thinking about how do we provide better systems for our shore-based operators in our command centers across our sectors and in our districts. And so we fielded this thing called Sextant, which uses ESRI, sort of the foundational ubiquitous GIS-enabled systems for our frontline operators. So they can then take these layers of data that they can find locally and then layer those into a common platform, a single pane of glass, I think is the term of art here. So they can take all these different data feeds and they can say, okay, I know that I have a fishing season in such a month. I know that my fishing vessels are out here. I can tell if there's somebody who isn't emitting, right? And so maybe I need to go send a small boat or a cutter out there to board that individual because maybe they're not going to be in compliance with our domestic fisheries laws. It's working with National Geospatial Intelligence Agency with all the great space-based geointelligence capabilities there. And the AI that they're using and trying to figure out how we can integrate those in a way that's meaningful to our Coast Guard operational folks. And then, of course, there's artificial intelligence, right? And that is just, you know, making leaps and bounds that our budget cycle just doesn't accommodate.
Yeah, so I hear a couple things there. The budget cycle is always lags technology, and in many cases lags the adversary. The legal, you know, the laws of our country, the legal framework, and the rules that by which we play also tend to lag technology. Technology comes and then Congress or governing agencies realize, oh, we need to have rules and regulations or laws to govern how we use that technology, whereas others may not, other nations may not be so worried about the legal structure as they are about getting the new technology out there. So those are daunting challenges.
Yeah, they're daunting, but they're also righteous. What you just mentioned, Bill, though, reminds me of our Coast Guard principles of operations. We got a set of 7 principles of operations. And so in this rapidly changing world, it's always good to just fall back on basic principles. And so these help guide us in terms of the principle of unity of effort, what we just talked about in Baltimore in terms of unified command. So that's a Coast Guard coxswain in a small boat that might be operating with a state law enforcement agency, and just doing a handshake, right, in terms of I'm doing this, you're doing that on field. But the final principle of operation is the principle of restraint. because we have very powerful law enforcement authorities that stem from those days of Alexander Hamilton. In fact, Alexander Hamilton wrote a note to the first commanding officers in the Revenue Cutter Service that said, be mindful that you are, Americans have just essentially thrown off the yoke of tyranny and do not like overbearing law enforcement agencies, right? So we need to be mindful of always following the
law. That's a great point.
At the same time and doing the things that we need to do.
Yeah, it makes me think, you know, in the Navy, before we go visit a foreign port, there's always in-depth briefings about the port, about the culture of the people that you're gonna go, and the constant reminder that you all of us sailors are diplomats, right? Where when we're in a foreign port, we're diplomats. And I hadn't thought until just now when you just said that for the Coast Guard, because of your law enforcement aspect, right, you're interacting with Americans on the waterways, and so your almost diplomatic envoys to the U.S. To American citizens, right? So it's a little bit of, I want to keep you safe, I want to make sure you're following the laws, but I also, to your point, it's got to be a deft touch.
Yeah, be mindful that Americans are freemen,
right,
is the way that Alexander Hamilton couched that. But, you know, it drives a culture in the Coast Guard operationally that just makes us great collaborators. I think as an agency that has humble resources, I think we learn from a very young age to reach out, partner, set common objectives with others, and just team up in ways that we can't, that are much more effective than just operating by ourselves.
That's great. Any questions you wish I'd asked or saved rounds, parting shots from you, sir?
Well, this is a great conversation, Bill. I really appreciate it here. But I think, you know, sitting on the campus, this great USNI headquarters here in the campus of Annapolis in the Naval Academy, we think all the time, too, about being joint force. And USNI continues to focus on the joint warfighting concept, how we prepare ourselves for potential conflicts of the future. Coast Guard is also very much in that. And one thing that we don't think about often enough is, as we think about away, as we think about joint war fighting in theaters of operation, we need to remember that we have to be prepared for all domain conflict, not just in the Indo-Pacific, not just in space, not just in cyberspace, but domestically. And so a number of us Coasties have been reading history about World War II, about what the home front looked like. And the Coast Guard took on huge responsibilities in terms of maritime security in World War II at the captain of the port level in terms of preserving our safety and security and defense in the homeland. So we've got to think both. Theater conflict, domestic, preserving our own safety and security, because if there are domestic attacks on the homeland, that is going to drive things in terms of what the military will be doing.
That's a great point. You know, the deep space, the deep battle space for the Western Pacific is still back here. It's CONUS, right, on our side. And the ability of an adversary these days with information, with cyber weapons, and with operatives, because we are a free and open country where there's lots of folks who come to the United States, and live in the United States from foreign, overseas countries, that you're making a very good point about the ability to project power is very much dependent on your security situation at home. That's a good point about the Coast Guard's role in making sure that the deep battle space back here remains viable, operating, that all of our systems that help us project power forward can continue to do that. Logistics, yeah. Informational, all of those things. That's a good point.
Coast Guard's going to play a big role. We have, you said, we wear many hats, but we've got feet in many different areas.
Yeah.
Coast Guard, U.S. Merchant Marine, National Guard, NORTHCOM, DOD. We're all going to have a role here in the homeland.
Wow. Well, lots to think about today, sir. That wraps up another episode of the Proceedings Podcast. My guest today has been Vice Admiral Peter Gaudier. He is the Deputy Commandant for Operations of the U.S. Coast Guard. Sir, thanks for stopping by. This was a really great conversation.
Yeah, thanks very much. This is terrific. Thanks for hosting me.
Our show today was brought to you by Valletta Industries.
Today's episode is brought to you by Valletta Industries. Valletta Industries is a premier maritime and tactical training company founded and comprised of former U.S. Navy SEALs. They offer best-in-class trainers for the Department of Defense and local law enforcement. The Valletta team has a passion for instructing and continuing to support the mission of active duty personnel and first responders by lending their hard-earned experience to those brave Americans who still serve. If you're a government contractor looking for a great partner for your next big project, Valletta Industries is an SBA-certified, HubZone, and SDVOSB company. Valletta Industries, we solve problems. To learn more, go to www.valettaindustries.com.
Until next episode, remember, victory begins at the Naval Institute.